Hi, Monk Podcast listeners. The following is a sample of the Monk Members Only podcast. To access the full-length edition of this episode and all of our regular Monk Members Only podcasts, go to our website, www.monkdebates.com, and register for membership. Membership is free, and it's available for you right now at www.monkdebates.com. Hope you enjoy the program. Hello, Monk members. Rudyard Griffiths here, your host and moderator. Welcome to this, our regular Monk Members Only podcast, where we dig into the big issues and ideas in the news, hopefully leaving you with some new and original analysis and insights. To do this, we are joined every week by Janice Gross Stein, the founding director of the Monk School of Global Affairs, an internationally renowned scholar and author. Janice, terrific to be in conversation with you again.
Good to be with you, Rudyard.
Well, here's what we're going to do on today's show. We're going to break this up into two halves. The first half, Janice, I really want to drill down on your latest thoughts of the developments of the last week. We spoke last Friday, so we've got 7 days to kind of catch up on. And then the second half of the show, I want to talk about our Monk Debate podcast out this week, a one-on-one debate on the Ukraine war and a resolution, be it resolved, NATO is partly responsible for Russian aggression in the Ukraine. So a controversial idea, but occasionally, Janice, and I will admit this, it's lightning doesn't strike all the time, but occasionally when we do these podcasts every week, month after month, everything falls together. You get two considered, well thought out debaters engaging on, I think, a key issue and topic, doing so with great civility and substance, but also a sense of history. As participants themselves in this debate, Barry Posen and Stephen Redmaker. So let's talk about that in the second half of the show, but I want to begin right off the bat to ask you the following question. Are we seeing the end of the beginning of this war or the beginning of the end? What's your sense of how things have played out over the last 7 days?
I think, Rudyard, the war has gotten more dangerous. It's gotten more dangerous for several reasons. First of all, and most important, is Putin, who gave two speeches this week that were deeply alarming. The tone of them was alarming. His anger was palpable. So this is somebody that is clearly emotionally overwrought. This was not in any way a measured speech. This was not the speech of somebody who recognizes that this has been a strategic disaster for Russia and that there is he should be looking for some kind of exit strategy or off-ramp. It was exactly the opposite. And secondly, and we're going to come to this in the second part of our discussion, so I don't want to say too much, but what he said really had almost nothing to do with Ukraine and nothing to do with NATO, but was in a much more deeply embedded view of Russia as the victim of the West. And scathing comments about Russian liberals as traitors and scum that needed to be expelled from Russia. It's clear, Rudyard, to anybody who's listening, this is about far more for Putin than Ukraine.
Yeah, let me try to build on that. I mean, I think the interesting thing of the last 7 days since we last talked last Friday is that the shift in a strategic balance of power here in terms of the specific kind of kinetic fight that we're seeing right now in Ukraine. And that is that Russian forces clearly have suffered casualties well beyond what they would have predicted.
6,000.
6,000 to 7,000. And I think you can, you know, generally treat these numbers are not from the Ukraine government. They're from the United States Department of Defense, the UK Department of Defense. I think there's some accuracy, you know, let's say pick a range. It's still very significant because you need to multiply that by 4 or 5 to think of the number of people who are now wounded and incapacitated. Then you need to think a little
Let's stop for 1 minute. It is an astronomical figure for Russia to have lost 6,000 dead in a month is unprecedented, far worse than what they encountered in Afghanistan, far worse than what the United States encountered in any of the wars it's fought. This is an, it is a catastrophe, frankly, for Russia, these numbers.
And then what I would say is walk back from the original invading force. Let's say it's 150, 160,000. There's this thing in the military called teeth to tail. So that's the number of support and supply troops you need to support the actual people who are fighting the war. You know, those ratios are often 5 to 1. Let's say Russia's a more efficient army, let's say, or cheaper army. They're doing it 3 to 1 or 4 to 1. You're still talking about combat unit losses of anywhere from 15 to 20%, fatalities, not simply casualties, but fatalities. So I think there's a sense here, and you can understand maybe why they have made no meaningful gains in the encirclement of Kiev, is because this army has ground to a halt. Its morale has plummeted. There are stories of widespread desertion. There's a sense here, Janice, of a kind of military collapse on the part of Russia, and worrying developments as the week goes on that the Russians now are having to resort to the tactics of Grozny in Syria, which is heavy artillery bombardment. But even then, it's not clear that they can continue to prosecute this war on the basis that either they don't have the ground troops or the ground troops won't fight. So one could say that this is a critical moment, because it, and this is what I want to ask you, is that how does that shift what happens next? I mean, is it conceivable that the Zelensky government says, look, we may not be ultimately winning this war in terms of pushing the Russians out of Ukraine, but why negotiate now? Why settle for some kind of partitioning, they would say dismembering of our country, when arguably the tactical balance of power has shifted over the last 7 to 10 days from Russia to Ukraine?
So I think you have identified the major shift, and let's just use as evidence here, Rudyard, the fact that Russia has called for foreign fighters. That really tells you everything. When you're recruiting foreign fighters, largely Syrians, to augment an army that has no operational reserves, it has no reserves that it can really throw into this fight anymore. That tells you how catastrophic this has been for Russia. Now, it's also catastrophic for Ukraine. The damage and destruction, which will only get worse as the Russians run out of smart weapons and start using heavy artillery fire against cities, the damage to the southern cities, we have not seen anything like this in Europe since World War II, frankly. There is no real protection. Yes, Ukraine is now getting a much more sophisticated anti-aircraft and anti-missile system than it had up till now. But when you have our heavy artillery that is moving up, bombing your cities, Zelensky and his government are seeing Ukraine, Western Ukraine, really destroyed before their eyes. The second big worry for Zelensky is how long those supply lines stay open. All this is made possible by a Western resupply of Russia, which is tantamount to the Berlin airlift. It is hard to exaggerate the massive amount of equipment which has come through Poland and Romania into Ukraine. And it's a land route. The material is offloaded in Polish and Romanian airports and driven across the border. if those supply routes are disrupted and he hasn't done it yet, which is interesting in itself why he has not, but he has not.
Well, he doesn't seem to be able to get air superiority, which again is another sign that this military campaign has kind of proverbially fallen flat on its face.
Absolutely. But those supply routes are vulnerable because they're convoys. They're visible from the air. So what you have here is both sides are very vulnerable. It is not only one. So what are we seeing then? We're seeing two tracks. We are seeing one track of negotiations between senior Ukrainian negotiators and Sergei Lavrov. And Lavrov said early this morning, well, he sees some grounds for optimism, a deal is close. Frankly, who would believe him at this point? If you look at his record, he's lied, or he is so out of touch with his president that he says one thing and his president pays no attention to what he's doing. So I think it's very hard to attach any credibility to any statement that that Putin himself does not issue. Now, what are you hearing out of Putin? Exactly what you and I talked about in the first part of the show. There is no sign that he's willing to de-escalate right now. And contrary to that, we are hearing reports from U.S. intelligence, which has proven to be very reliable, that they are warning again and again and again against the use of any chemical weapons, which is not inconceivable given how badly this war is going for Putin and the inevitable temptation for furious Putin, because that's the only way you can describe him, at a fever pitch of intensity, to lash out. And that's why this is, I think, a deeply worrying moment.
Mm-hmm. I think the lashing out could also be simply a response that, you know, your conventional forces are no longer a tool to pursue your policy. And effectively, your army is broken. So then you reach into that horrible, diabolical toolkit of chemical or biological or other weapons to try to create a moment of kind of existential doubt and crisis for the Ukraine government that forces them to capitulate. I mean, I guess I just wonder, Janice, if looking at that Putin speech, if there was also another audience that he was criticizing, and it's worth, you know, listeners going back and just watching it on YouTube or elsewhere, because it really is quite a remarkable performance. I wondered if there was a criticism in that speech of his oligarchs. If this is a leader who, again, during the pandemic and maybe before, became very remote and removed from reality and believed that he had one army and one set of capabilities, but in fact, his very coterie of oligarchs that he surrounded himself with, like many militaries through history, were engaged in large-scale profiteering. And basically what Putin ended up with is a Potemkin army. He ended up with a set of tools that were not the set of tools that he thought he had. And the result now is not simply a catastrophic economy and a plunging ruble and 20% interest rates and soaring inflation, but literally on the battlefield, a series of conventional forces assembled in units who are now no longer being supplied, who are experiencing mass desertion, who have lost the will and the morale to fight. I mean, is it conceivable, Janice, that we may be witnessing just the complete collapse of the Russian army in Ukraine and Putin, in a sense, forced into the reversal of what we thought a week ago, which is Putin suing for peace effectively? I mean,
I think we have to
wishful
be cautious.
Thinking or
I think we have to be cautious here, Rudyard. Certainly what we heard out of Ukraine is they are now going on the counteroffensive. They are starting to attack in a massive way, especially in the south, Russian artillery and tanks. They are pushing back, which lends some credence to the arguments that we've been making that the Russian army is in deep trouble. That's a far cry, though, from the collapse, from the total collapse of the Russian army. You know, let's distinguish for a minute, Rudyard, the oligarchs on the one hand, who are the people who have become multi-billionaires by mm-hmm. buying up Russian industry when there was a fire sale mm-hmm. in the 1990s, and two other groups that really matter here. The FSB, which is a secret service reinvented each time there's a new president in Russia. These and the FSB are Putin's cronies. And these are the five or six men that Putin has seen regularly mm-hmm. over the last years. He's seen nobody else. Because in order to see...
But maybe Putin, these are the men that deluded him, that built, you know, you see these super yachts in Cannes and Italy and elsewhere. These
they don't own those yachts.
Fantasies of affluence. Some of them do, though. Some of the businessmen that are part of this inner circle do. And you kind of wonder if they just stole not just from Russia, but they robbed Putin blind. They robbed yeah. him of the very thing that he thought he had, which was this powerful surgical, you know, conventional force that had proven itself to tragic ends in Aleppo, in Syria, that had fought successfully in again horrific ways against the Chechens in Grozny. But
that
Janice,
was
what
done.
What if there's no there was... there to quote Dorothy Parker, and it's just a question. I'm schizophrenic. I agree. Like, I've just completely flipped the last week. I just wonder if we just kick the door down, there's nothing there on the other side. It's
no,
just
I think we have to be really careful.
It is a kleptocracy that has robbed itself of in a sense the capacity to pursue the very policies that it sought out to pursue. They're Look, victims of their own avarice and greed. I mean, it's a perfect tragedy.
Yeah. So let me just distinguish the three groups here for a minute, because they're so different. The yacht owning oligarchs are in the industrial sector and in finance. They are not the people providing any military advice. Zero. Mm-hmm. There's two groups that are providing the critical advice to Putin right now. One of the FSB, the Secret Service, and people like Dugin, who believe in, who are responsible for Putin's deep engagement with Russian history and Russian mysticism and the Slavic people, which so infuses the tone of his speeches now. That's one group. The second group is Defense Minister Shoigu and Chief of the Defense Staff, Vladimir Gerasimov. These are the people that modernized the Russian army 8 or 9 years ago.
And failed. It's clearly have failed spectacularly.
They're the
mission.
Problem. They're the problem. But they are.
So what's Putin thinking about these guys?
Well, that's really interesting. And that's the big question, because Putin created them. He's mm-hmm. the one who found them, promoted them. They delivered for him in Syria. They, you know, they blistered Aleppo into rubble. So these are the people that told him this is a week's war and that's all. What yeah. does he do?
A blitzkrieg.
Blitzkrieg. That's what he, and we know from intelligence, who's listening to the chatter, that that's what he was told by Shoigu. How long does the defense minister last? How long does the chief of the mm-hmm. army last? Three generals have been killed at the front. So the mm-hmm. real, I think the moment to watch for in this story is if and when Shoigu loses his job, if Putin fires him. Now, we're talking about 200,000 men that have been moved up, all the way, some of them from the east, who are the sharp end of the spear here. There is a long tail behind. So to argue that the state will collapse, the security services are still intact. This is not a state without the capacity to use coercive force. It has an enormous amount of artillery and heavy armor left that it is now moving forward. And it has, unfortunately, the largest stockpile of nuclear weapons in the world, which is a very strong deterrent. It is deterring the West from all the things that Zelensky is asking for, like a no-fly zone. This is not a state that's going to implode on itself. I don't believe that.
Any
which makes it worse. Which makes it worse.
Yeah, no, I know. Because you try to think through, well, then how does this end? If the Ukrainians, in a sense, have the wind in their sails, so to speak, to use a poor metaphor, but I can't think of another one right now. They are understandably going to say, well, you know, we're not going to concede to these massive territorial losses and, you know, force neutrality. And at the same time, what can Putin do? He can't concede to allowing them to join the European community because the loss of face, it would essentially reveal the Potemkin
quality.
Reality of modern Russia to the world now. The Estonians and others are starting to say, well, maybe we're not really that afraid of Russia anymore because look how bumbling and ineffective and chaotic and inept this invasion has been.
My sense listening to Zelensky all week as he spoke and to the Canadian Parliament and the US Congress, this is a man who wants a ceasefire. And what we know of those negotiations that are going on with Lavrov, and you know, the United States is coordinating fully. We're getting full details. You know, Ukraine has agreed to neutrality. It's agreed to the loss of the Donbass. It's agreed to the loss of Crimea. That's already done. What's left is very little, frankly. If you look at what Russia has historically demanded, they've said demilitarization. That's out of the question. The Ukrainians will have an army, and they've said security guarantees rather than joining the European Union, which would really mean joint NATO-Russian security guarantees. There is not a great deal of substance dividing these two sides right now, Rudyard. What's the big issue that is standing in the way of a ceasefire right now?
So why are you I know you're concerned about this right now. So what you just said makes me think, well, maybe we're a few days away from some kind of ceasefire agreement because the Russian military is collapsing. The fields are turning from frozen tundra that their tanks can roll over to giant mud pits that are going to bog them and their heavy artillery down from now through to next, you know, December.
The big question, and how ironic that everyone's fate hangs on one man. There is I have seen nothing, Rudyard, that says that Putin is prepared to agree to a face-saving ceasefire in which he could say to his people, we claim victory, we got everything we asked for, Ukraine is dismembered, Ukraine is neutralized. He could turn around and say all of that. What you saw on the contrary was what I think is an opening attack on Russians themselves who have the remotest sympathy for anything in the West, for Western lifestyles inside Russia. I think we will see, even if a ceasefire is enforced, we are going to see repression in Russia that is unimaginable. None of what we call the blob, you know, the famous description of the Washington chattering classes and the me's of Canada, none of us will survive in Russia. He is, in fact, pleased to see the flight of westernized Russians from Russia because he wants a de-westernized Russia that is repressive. On a scale that we have not seen in Russia since Stalin. It's very concerning. I'm not convinced that he can be, in the short term, that he can be brought to the table to agree to a ceasefire. It doesn't matter what Lavrov negotiates. If Putin doesn't sign off, there's no ceasefire. Mm-hmm. He has a long-term hatred of the West. That is what has become transparent in these speeches.
So before we go to break, let's just play that out then. So let's say he is committed to some, you know, revanchist theory of the West, which then requires him to prosecute this war. To what end does he prosecute it? I mean, what is the next phase we would see that would lead to some outcome that he would want to achieve through brute force. I mean, his army is effectively neutralized. I mean, he is not encircling Kiev. The entire west of Ukraine, yes, is subject to missile strikes and fighter bomber attacks, but those themselves have also been degraded, and they'll be degraded more as these new Western anti-aircraft systems come into place.
The question is, how long does somebody so emotionally out of control, let me choose my words carefully, so angry, how long does it take until the realities on the ground penetrate? Who among the senior military advisors are going to say this is not reversible? Which of these generals and his minister of defense that he appointed and he created and whose careers depend entirely on him are going to tell him how the battlefield situation has deteriorated?
So which he may not actually know what's happening. Correct. Again, we may be in this kind of courtier culture where the information that he's receiving is edited and glossed to perfection.
Well, we saw how he treated his chief of intelligence services. We saw it online. Who's now been arrested. Exactly. Yeah. So imagine being the bearer of bad tidings to Vladimir Putin right now.
not a prospect for the faint-hearted.
Why it's worrying, frankly.
Okay, let's take a break. When we'll come back, we're going to chat about our one-on-one Monk Debate podcast this week that explored the topic of NATO's role possibly in creating some of the preconditions of this crisis. Back to you with that conversation right after this short break. You've been listening to a sample of the Monk Members Only podcast. To access the rest of the episode, consider becoming a member. Membership is free and available at www.monkdebates.com. Once you've joined as a member, go to your membership profile to access the rest of this episode and all of our Monk Members podcasts. Thanks for listening.